So Matthew chapter 9, verses 18 to 26, let me read. While Jesus was saying these things to them, behold, a ruler came in and knelt before him, saying, "My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live." And Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. And behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. For she said to herself, "If I only touch his garment, I'll be made well." Jesus turned, and seeing her, he said, "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well." And instantly the woman was made well. And when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, "Go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went through all that district.
Thank you, Tom. Please keep the passage open as we go. It'll help you to refer to it. So our passage introduces us to a man who, if you read other Gospels, we know his name is Jairus. And he is an influential man. He is resourceful. He has friends in high places, but none of that would help him on what must be the worst day of his life. Death is always upsetting when people get wrenched away from us unexpectedly, but the death of a child, we don't know how long it took, we don't know if it was an illness, maybe it was sudden, but the girl Jairus would have loved since the day he first held her has been taken away, now lying vacant and motionless in front of him. In his desperation, Jairus finds himself in front of Jesus on his knees, begging him for help. "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her, and she will live." I don't know what you think, but I find that there is a strange sense of confidence in that request from Jairus. "Put your hand on her, and she will live." Will, that is a pretty strong word. Maybe he could have added a perhaps, or a possibly, or a probably, just to cover himself. But Jairus believes in miracles, and specifically believes that Jesus can work miracles. Jesus can raise the dead, and he is sure that if Jesus comes back with him, well, he gets his daughter back that day. In many ways, his confidence is remarkable, but if you are a Christian, or even if you've just read the chapter before this one in Matthew, you would see we've got plenty of reasons to be confident that Jesus can do this. Section of Matthew's Gospel that this is in runs from chapters 8 to 10, and it is where Jesus does miracle after miracle to demonstrate his power and authority. All these miracles, he raises the dead, he casts out demons, he heals all sorts of sickness. They show that Jesus has authority like no one else you've ever met. Nothing is beyond his control. He is the Son of God, and he's here to rescue people from everything that spoils life in this world. And as Jesus shows his power in this part of Matthew, he makes clear that faith is the appropriate response to him. And the idea is that he wants us to recognize his authority as he shows himself. And so for Jairus, when we see his faith in this passage, that belief that Jesus can help him, however big the trouble he's in, yes, absolutely, we should think. That is an absolutely appropriate way to look at Jesus, reasonable to expect. But when Jairus gets Jesus to his house, his friends and family don't see it the same way. And they don't share that confidence when Jesus comes in and tells them in verse 24, when he tells the mourning crowd to cut it out, because don't worry, she's going to be fine. What's all the commotion about? He thinks that she's just taking a nap, but they laugh at him. The crowd laughs at him because they know what death looks like, and this girl hasn't been moving in a while. They are skeptical of this idea that a man could raise someone back to life from the dead. Maybe actually skeptical is an understatement. They look at Jesus with mouths wide open and laugh at him when he tells them that she's going to be okay. They're full of disbelief, and so we might think that Jairus has made all the right moves in this situation. But to the room full of people who are convinced that there's no such thing as coming back from the dead, To them, Jairus is just a desperate fool holding on to whatever faint hope he can find, because it's just too painful for him to accept the reality. His daughter is dead. I think they would have pitied him. That is the normal response when we see people in this sort of position. We all know that grief makes people desperate, and Jairus hasn't quite made it yet to that stage of acceptance. He's on the one that we call bargaining, and it's sad to see. And so what we see in this episode of Matthew 9 is not only another display of Jesus' authority, but a backdrop of doubt and disbelief in the face of it. Because Matthew, as he writes his account, he doesn't want us just to understand Jesus, to know that he has power to save us, but also to prepare us for when people don't respond the same way. To prepare us to see people make the wrong response to Jesus. These guys were skeptical of the man claiming to be God and promising to raise people from the dead. You will know plenty today who similarly would snort at that idea that Jesus has power over death. Just try it out at your next meeting this afternoon if you like. Go in and tell people that this lunchtime you heard that Jesus can resurrect people. See how seriously they take you. And when people think that it's absurd to believe in Jesus, and when we're surrounded by that, it can make us just wonder whether our confidence is well placed. And when people think it's not real, that kind of skepticism can knock us somewhat in our belief if we're around it enough. And I think we're supposed to see in this passage the contrast between Jairus and the rest of the people at this funeral. He is in the minority in his beliefs. But what I want to show us is that Jairus is no idiot. Apart from it, I think that Jairus is the only person in the room thinking rationally about Jesus. Jairus is right, and they are wrong. And at the end of the passage, the story that spreads across the region isn't that some poor buffoon ruined his daughter's funeral by telling the guests to stop crying. Got two headings for us this lunchtime. First, about what Jesus can do, and second, about how we can know for sure. And at the end of each, I want to just make a little comment on what this says about skepticism in the world around us. So first heading, Jesus can save you from death. I'll read again from verse 25. This is the part that people were talking about afterwards. After the crowd had been put outside, Jesus went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. Jesus saves her from death, and you could miss it very easily if you read the way that I often do, where you just sort of scan down the page, daydreaming about what show you'll watch when you'll get home. And Matthew mentioned this so briefly, but those four words at the end of verse 25 that almost come across casually, she got up. It is all we actually need to understand what's happened. The girl has come back from the dead, just as Jairus told us that she would. Jesus reaches out the hand, he makes contact, and the girl is back. And don't miss the obvious. This is a resurrection. The girl was dead. Her father knew it. Her family knew it. The whole crowd at the funeral knew it. And even if he'd somehow got this wrong, you think someone else would have caught it. This is an extraordinary miracle that Jesus has performed. It's not normal. Even in the whole Bible, resurrections aren't common. I can only think of three times in the whole Old Testament that someone rises again from the dead. But here is Jesus, and just with a simple touch of the hand, her nervous system sparks back into life. Oxygen pumps through her arteries, and the lights come back on. She's back. And I think for us to start to understand the impact of this power that Jesus has, we need to reckon with why death is so terrifying and so awful, why it's such a problem for us. And what Jesus does here is so good precisely because of how awful death is. In some ways, it is just obvious, it has been obvious for everyone who's ever walked the planet, why death is a problem. Everyone understands that. I'm sure some of us, even today, will be personally affected by death somewhere around us. Death is terrible. Some of us will be painfully aware of that right now. But lots of people do try to go through life just avoiding the thought of it. I've had a few conversations recently with people about death, and the conversation has gone pretty much the same every time. So if someone says, do you hear this person has died or is dying? The next person says, yeah, that's terrible, isn't it? The first person says, yeah, it is awful. Really, really sad. And then there's a sort of silence, and we both kind of stare past each other for a moment, not knowing what to do until someone moves the conversation on. Because what do you say? How do you recover from that? We tend to try and put it out of our mind if we can. But if we can face the reality of death, well, when we look at this passage, you can see the glory that Jesus brings as he deals with it. So forgive me for dwelling here for a moment. But why is it that we're afraid of death? I think for one thing, we fear death because we don't know what happens on the other side. Who knows what's waiting for us after we die? What if there's nothing? What if this is it and it's all over? I think also we fear death because we hate the thought of losing everything that's good to us, that we love. Life is full of good things that we enjoy: family, friends, hobbies, holidays. Maybe you've just bought a new gadget or a sofa or something and you're enjoying your possessions. Death is awful because it steals all of that from us, everything that we know and love. We fear death because we know it's unstoppable. What do you do to get in the way and to delay or prevent it? We fear death because it's unpredictable. In my old job, I worked with university students, and over the last few years, I met regularly with two guys who died before they made it to graduation. Both of them were fit, bright, health-conscious guys. Both of them, within a year of being diagnosed, died of cancer. And we feel much safer if death was only for kind of some people at some point. So if you could only die when you hit 70, or if death was only for people who were obviously particularly sickly, we could feel safe. But that's not how death works. It doesn't discriminate. No one is safe. And Jesus is saying he can save us from death. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in, took the girl by the hand, and she got up. So just think for a moment of the joy for Jairus, the relief of the friends and families at the funeral when Jesus does verse 25. Think about how the girl felt when she came back to get her life again, to be reunited with her dad, to sit at the family table again, to sing, to laugh, to play. And from Jesus, this is a statement of intent. This is an amazing miracle, but it's not a one-off story. And the passages around this one, Jesus announces that he is instituting the kingdom of heaven. So if you flip back to chapter 8, verse 11, Jesus says, "I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven." If you flip just beyond our passage to chapter 9, verse 35, he talks about it again. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom. But each one is a little demonstration, a picture of what his kingdom of heaven is going to be like. So what Jesus does in verse 25 of our passage is what he plans on doing with everyone who follows him. If you are with Jesus, after you die, he will take you by the hand and breathe life into your deflated lungs and bring you to a kingdom where no one will ever die again. You can imagine the way that Jairus felt, the way his daughter felt. Then you can imagine something of what it will be like to live in that kingdom. So imagine living with no uncertainty over your future, where you won't need a will, and where you won't need life insurance. There wouldn't be any point. Because if you get rid of death, there is no more bad end on the horizon. We're so accustomed to this world where death is around that I think we find it quite hard to visualize what that would be like. It can be difficult to imagine a world where death... I turned 30 recently, and I think that the milestone ages get scarier as you go through. When you hit 40, when you hit 50, when you hit 60. But in the kingdom of heaven, when I turn 300, I still won't have any reason to fear death. It's no closer than when I was 250. The parts we love about living won't be taken from us. Nor will we ever experience the grief of losing a friend, or a family member, or a child. We won't have to worry about how long it's been since we've seen the doctor. We will feel healthy all the time without that decline that creeps in inevitably over the years. You will feel so safe knowing that Jesus will never let death near you. Don't make a mistake here. This is not promising that we won't die now. Both the students I mentioned, they were clear Christians, and Jesus let them die. This passage is about resurrection. It's about what happens after you die. The hope is for a kingdom without death in the future. That is what one day the world will be like under Jesus. And until that day, when death continues to surround us on all sides, we need that hope. We need to know Jesus who can save us from death. And I think the challenge of this to the skeptic is that we all face death, and yet Jesus is the only good answer. A few weeks ago, I was off to see my parents for the weekend, and I was in a little town in the countryside of Oxfordshire, just kind of wandering around on a busy Saturday lunchtime. There are kids out on the street, people eating lunch, lots of hustle and bustle. But when we walked around to the part of the town with the church, suddenly it was just abandoned. There was no one there. The doors were closed, and it didn't look like anyone had been in for a while. And I thought in that moment, that's a pretty fair reflection of where church and Jesus and Christianity sit in the life of most of the people I know in London. I suspect it's true of that little town as well. Where it's become less and less relevant in people's lives to believe in God or to get to know him better. But then we went around the back of the church and there was a graveyard. And the graves near the church, they were from the 1800s. And we looked at those for a while, but as you got further away, the dates became more and more recent. And we got to 1850 and 1900 and 1950, 1980, 1990. And at the very far end were brand new gravestones with 2020, 2021, 2022 written on them. And however irrelevant Jesus and the church were to the lives of these people in this town, they all ended up there eventually. Became relevant, these people who would laugh at Jesus and think they have no need for them. Death makes him relevant to everyone. And so to the skeptic, what is their answer to death? What's the plan? What have they got to help them through it? Or are they just casting rocks from a glass tower? Jesus can save you from death. And more briefly, heading number two, you can trust him. So this kingdom of heaven offers wonderful hope, if you dare to imagine what life would be like without death around anymore. But I want us to see, just briefly, that Jesus is credible in this offer. So let me lay out the logic to see why Jesus is worth trusting and how you make that decision. And then if people want to follow up with it afterwards in questions or discussions, I'd be very happy to say more. So miracles. For a lot of people, miracles are the sticking point when it comes to Jesus. I've had friends tell me they like the Bible, they can't get on board with this Jesus who can raise people from the dead. I think some of this skepticism comes from a misunderstanding or a misapplication of the scientific method. The Bible's claim isn't that miracles are normal, that we should expect to be able to repeat them or see them regularly. Actually, the whole point is that they're not normal. Jesus does miracles to show that he's not like other people. That is what he's demonstrating. As he claims to offer life beyond the grave, he backs it up by doing something that no one else can. And the miracles function as a kind of proof that he can do what he's saying he can do. You can trust him because he does miracles. I'm a bit of a sucker for those health advice YouTube videos. My YouTube feed is full of them. People talking about smoothies or workouts or pills or ice baths. You name it. And I think the reason I'm drawn to them is because I want what they're selling. I want health. And they've managed somehow to convince me at least a little bit that they can deliver on that offer with whatever wacky product they've got. They show you the before and after, and then you think, yeah, that might work for me. Go get the ice bath ready. And that's what Jesus does with the miracles. It's a proof or a demonstration of what he's selling. If he can raise this girl from the dead, well, you better believe he can do it for you. Can do it for me. And then the question comes, how do we know the miracles happened? And the answer is to understand what it is that we're reading. This is eyewitness testimony in Matthew's gospel. It was written by a guy called Matthew who knew Jesus and personally witnessed the events that he's writing about. He was there on that day when Jesus raises this girl from the dead. And what you need to do with eyewitness testimony is decide, does this person who wrote this know what they're talking about? And do I think that I have what they wrote? or has it changed over the last 2,000 years? And I suggest that if people saw Jesus doing miracles, and if we know that we have what they saw and it's not been changed, then that is compelling reason to trust that Jesus can deliver that ultimate miracle of raising people from the dead. Compelling evidence for us to trust him too. So Jesus offers hope in the face of death, but it's hope that we can be certain of. The Christian doesn't approach death with just a hunch or a good feeling or a kind of maybe this will all be okay, but with actual confidence because Jesus has proven his ability. So if a Christian friend dies, we grieve them, but in assurance that Jesus will see them through death safely to the other side. It makes all the difference to know that. And I think, again, this is a real challenge to the skeptic. When they dismiss Jesus, when they just out of hand say they don't believe in the claims of life after death, I think the question to have in mind is, what have they done with the evidence? How do they explain away the miracles? What conclusion do they reach upon reading Matthew's gospel if it doesn't point to Jesus' power to save us from death? Actually, in my experience, most people have made up their minds without really seriously considering that evidence much. They don't bother to look at it. Absurd. So I suggest this passage helps us not to be thrown when we meet that kind of evidence and just believed it because they believe it. You have all the reason in the world, if you have followed the evidence, seen the miracles, heard what you said with Jesus, it will be okay for us. He will suggest to you. Father, we thank you for this clear picture of Jesus and demonstration of his power. Thank you so much that he has an answer to the thing that we fear most, and the thing that causes us so much pain and grief and hurt. Thank you that Jesus will raise his followers from the dead, and we pray that you'd help us to trust that with the kind of confidence that changes the way that we see death, both as we think about our own and those people around us. Please, would this help us to be more confident in Jesus and to be more grateful for knowing him. In his name, amen.